Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my co-host, Dr. Pettis Perry. Hey, Pettis, how you doing?
I'm doing really well today, Jill. I think I'm doing a little bit better than you guys down in California. Oh. I hear you guys have a recall election going on for a new governor or for a governor.
It is terrifying, Pettis. And I did want to take a minute. It is so terrifying that I want to say that if the right wing gets California, the most powerful of all the states, the most populous of all the states, and the fifth GDP economy in the world, it's going to be a real blow to democracy in this state. You know, the Governor Newsom was elected with 62% of the vote, but because of this bizarre amendment to our state, California constitution, he could be replaced with someone who could win the recall election with a significantly lower percentage.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And the person who is leading the opposition right now is Larry Elders. There are 46 opponents on the ballot, but what I figured is most of it is people wanting to, you know, branding opportunities for themselves. But Larry Elders is being taken seriously. And as Maya Angelou once said, when someone tells you who they are, believe them.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I want to tell listeners who Larry Elders is just for a minute. He's a conservative talk show host, and he doesn't believe in fighting the climate emergency. He doesn't call it a hoax, but he calls it too expensive. And I'm going, as opposed to what?
the
loss of civilization. Or even in California, what would be the future of our wildfire fighting if he doesn't think, if it thinks it's too expensive, just let towns like Paradise just go, as we've already lost that town? So he's a scary guy. Elders, needless to say, opposes a women's right over her own body, any gun safety regulations, masks, vaccines, so on and so forth. And then also, I find this, when he does video messaging, he wears a robe monogrammed with the letters RR on it, which is for robe rage. I mean, that's just plain weird to me.
No, I think that is a big statement, just to be wearing a white robe and all of that, what that symbolizes, at least in my world. The thing that concerns me about what you're talking about is to have 46 other people or 45 other people on the ballot. They'll be siphoning votes that potentially could go to Newsom. So that's a very scary proposition, not just for you in California, but for the rest of us in this country. And really, I think the world, when you talk about the size of the economy and the impact that those kinds of decisions could have on the rest of not just the United States, but the world.
That's an excellent point, Pettis. You know, even more terrifying. And leading to another terrifying thing, Larry Elders was also Stephen Miller's mentor, and he thinks Stephen Miller should be president.
My goodness gracious.
I know, and he denies systemic racism for black people, and he's black, for goodness sakes.
No way.
Yes.
And then I'll call him up in a minute as soon as we get off this.
Well, let me tell you one more thing for your phone call. Elders promotes false and debunked statistics that's been shoveled out for a long time by well-known white supremacist Jared Taylor. Here's a quote from Jared Taylor, quote, "Blacks and whites are different. When blacks are left entirely to their own devices, Western civilization, any kind of civilization, disappears." And
amazing.
Larry Elders promotes Jared Taylor's false and debunked statistics to prove himself right.
Well, he'll find that he doesn't have any friends if that kind of propaganda goes by the wayside. He'll be the lone person, probably becoming their entertainment. So it's a very troubling message that you're giving today.
Well, as Rob Reiner said of Larry Elders, he says, this is a crazy man.
People see it that way. So Californians, please get busy.
Yeah.
We can't have this happen.
It's not a Democratic or Republican versus Republican issue. It really is a sane versus crazy issue. I'm recommending no on the recall, and for everybody to tell their friends and make sure they vote.
Yes, please, California.
I mean, yeah. They used to say California, you know, so goes California, so goes a nation. But I think you made the point about it. So goes can the world, too.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a Cali boy. I was raised in California.
Yes,
and lived there most of my life. So I have a deep concern about this.
And who knows, folks, maybe you'll come back someday.
I hope to.
On to our program. I just had to get that out. So, you know, misery loves company.
Well, this is a great show. We're not going to be miserable today.
Not today. No, this is going to be good. We have a fellow Star Trekker to talk with.
That's right.
Our program today is Being Muslim on the Other Side of the Veil. The Sharia-based system of laws and ethics would never have survived for a millennium had it not been equitable. However, through scare tactics and deliberate misinformation campaigns in this country, anti-Muslim propagandists insist wrongly that Sharia is a draconian and oppressive Islamic law that all Muslims must abide by. Since our guest interview with us earlier this month, Afghanistan fell to the Taliban. The Taliban say they're establishing an Islamic state, but will it really be an Islamic state? Will the Taliban be adhering to Islamic laws and ethics written in the Quran? Or are they creating something else to serve their own purposes? In addition, our guest, when our guest was on last, Petta said I couldn't get through all of our questions about Sharia. So we'll be delving into many more aspects, such as what is the Islamophobic industry? We all should have a better understanding of our fellow Muslim Americans during these times. Our future depends on it. So, Pettis, would you be so kind as to introduce our guest and fellow Star Trek fan?
It is my absolute pleasure. Our bold guest today is Sumbul Ali Karamali. Sumbul is the author of Demystifying Sharia, What It Is, How It Works, and Why It's Not Taking Over Our Country. She's an award-winning author and popular speaker whose books, articles, blogs, and speaking events are her way of promoting intercultural understanding in the world. Sumbul grew up in Southern California answering questions about Islam and Muslims. With her degree in English from Stanford University, her law degree from the University of California at Davis, and her second law degree in Islamic law from the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies, she left the world of corporate law to start writing books to answer those very questions. For more information or to reach Sumbul, you can reach her at her website, SumbulAliKaramali.com. We have big things to do. Jill?
Well, Sumbul, welcome back to Be Bold America.
Well, thank you so much for having me back. It's great to talk to you both again. I have to confess, I'm really terrified after your intro, Jill.
You live in California, don't you?
Yeah, well, I do. And, I would add my plea to yours, make sure everybody go out and vote.
Absolutely. This is no time to be sitting on the sidelines. And before I ask you my heavy question to get us starting, Sumbul, I just wanted to tell you that sometimes when I tell my husband I love him, I say to infinity and beyond. Just to get us laughing a little bit before we go into, not that I love my husband, I love him dearly. It's just that I say infinity and beyond in the Star Trek vein. That's how much of a Star Trek fan I am.
Well, I totally get it. And, you know, when I was listening to you talking about Larry Elder, and of course we know about Stephen Miller, and then my field, of course, is Islamic law, but also, you know, how Muslims are treated and Islamophobia. You know, the root of all that stuff, and also, you know, that the white robe, right? We all know what that symbolizes, the KKK, and all of that comes from fear. And, you know, xenophobia is just fear. And I think that the first thing that we need to do is stop being fearful. You know, stop being fearful of people who are not like us, and stop being fearful of opinions that are not like ours necessarily. And I think that would be a great step towards conquering some of that xenophobia and promoting some intercultural understanding of all kinds.
Well, I think the intercultural understanding really helps lower that fear when you get to know someone. And Sambal, you were on the program just a few weeks ago, and in the meantime, Afghanistan fell to the Taliban. And Pettis and I really wanted to hear your views on this situation, because the Taliban say they're establishing an Islamic state, but are they really? From what we have learned from reading your book, Demystifying Sharia, their positions really seem extreme. What are your views?
Yeah, so first of all, in a nutshell, the Taliban are like the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, both groups murder and are out for power, and they do it by justifying their actions on the basis of religion. Now, most Muslims revile the Taliban and don't think they have anything to do with Islam, just as most Christians would revile the KKK and think they have nothing to do with Christianity. The only reason that the Taliban is more successful than the KKK is because the Taliban is operating in a failed state, a state where the government is weak, where the country has suffered half a century of warfare, and where there is really nobody to stop them. And by the way, the KKK did come to power themselves in the early 20th century in Indiana. So, what's keeping them in their place is that we have a strong government and we have a strong nation state. But in countries that are a mess, like Afghanistan, there are power voids and it's very easy to come to power. So the Taliban are like the KKK. Also, the Taliban clearly violate well-established rules of Islam. So they're not bringing back Sharia. They don't know what Sharia is. In Islam, under Sharia, you are not allowed to take a life except in very, very circumscribed situations, which are pretty much the same as our modern Western law. So you are never allowed to take a life unless it's in self-defense of imminent harm, or if it's the death penalty after a fair trial, or if it's in legitimate warfare. And under Islam, even our definition of legitimate warfare is very, very narrow. So the Taliban killing protesters, well, that's just murder. It's murder under Islamic law, under Sharia. Assaulting women, killing women, that's just murder. Like, nobody is allowed to be assaulted or killed under Islamic law.
Well, so, and also talk a bit about how they treat women and girls. It seems that's different from, I mean, there have been, 13 female Muslim prime ministers in this world?
14 now.
14.
So 14 Muslim women have been presidents or prime ministers of Muslim populations in just the last few decades alone. That is more presidents and prime ministers than we've had women presidents in this country.
14 more. Yeah.
And so, people are shocked when I tell them this, because one of my friends who is a psychiatrist said, "Oh, well, how can they be presidents when they're hidden away?" And I was like, "They're not hidden away, and that's how they could become president?" We have these very, very strong impressions and stereotypes, which mostly come from media putting in front of us visions of Saudi women and Afghan women, and that's the sum total of what we think of when it comes to women. But I want to say, and the Taliban also will say ridiculous things, like they're going back to the time of the Prophet. But the thing is, the Prophet never forced a woman, Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century, never forced a woman to cover her hair. He took women with him to war. He consulted with women. His widow led an army. He made a woman the imam of a mixed-gender household. So he treated women in a much different way from what the Taliban do, which is essentially, you know, they treat them like slaves. That is not what Sharia is what Sharia allows. In fact, the Quran and Muhammad gave women in the 7th century the right to divorce, the right to enter into their own contracts, the right to retain custody of their young children. It gave them legal personhood, so they could manage their own property after marriage even. Norman Daniel was a British historian, and he said that it is justly said that the Quran and Muhammad gave women more rights in the 7th century than English women would have for another 1,000 years. So Islam was feminist. I mean, when it came down, it was a feminist religion. One of the main drivers in Islam was improving the status of women. Now, why do we see these problems then, right? Why do we see all these images of oppressed women?
Sumble, can I put a hold on that thought as you're changing thoughts? Because it's that time for a promo break. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is being Muslim on the other side of the veil. If you have ideas for the show, you may reach Pettis or me by emailing info@KSQD.org. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Todd Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
Now, back to our bold and impressive guest, Sumble Ali Karamali. She's an award-winning author and popular speaker whose books, articles, blogs, and speaking events are her way of promoting intercultural understanding in the world. Learn more about Sumble at SumbleAliKaramali.com. I'm sorry I interrupted you there, Sumble. Just carry on. Carry on, because it's just been fascinating.
That's okay. And I also wanted to say, if you can't remember how to spell my name, then MuslimNextDoor.com will also get you there.
Oh, say that again, please.
The website is MuslimNextDoor, all one word, .com.
Oh, good. Thank you.
It's easier to remember than my name.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what I was saying is that, well, you know, people might wonder, well, why doesn't Islam and it seemed like a feminist religion now, you know, when we hear all this stuff about oppressed women. And so a couple things. One is that in the 18th and 19th centuries, Western colonialism disrupted the development of Islamic law and women's rights because nearly 90% of Islamic lands, Muslim lands, were colonized. So when Judaism and Christianity modernized in response to the Industrial Revolution, Islam couldn't because Muslim lands were subjugated. Now, it's been about 50 years since Muslim countries have achieved independence, but they're still developing countries, and they're still coming out from under the yoke of colonialism. Many of them are poor, and developing countries and poor countries always disadvantage women, whether they're Christian majority or Hindu majority or Buddhist majority. And finally, our perceptions are skewed because we only see, you know, the women in the burqas. But as I said, 14 Muslim women have been presidents or prime ministers. And also, last time I checked, 18 Muslim majority countries had more women in their legislatures than the United States does. Iran has more women than men in its universities. And I often tell people, if you really want to know what Islam says about women, compare apples to apples. Like, don't compare American women to Muslim women over there in some poor developed country.
Good point.
Compare American women with Muslim American women. And then you find that Muslim American women are doing very well. They have the second highest level of education of any faith group, just after Jewish American women. They have the most parity of income of any race group. That means that Muslim women and Muslim men have the same level of income, which is more than any other faith group, where the salary levels are much more separate and unequal. So I think, you know, those are the women that we don't see on the media all the time, right? It's easy to point to a woman in a burqa because she stands out, and that's who we see, and we know that she's Muslim. But if I were walking down the street, you wouldn't know I was Muslim unless I said so.
That's true. This is excellent. Pettis, you have a question, I know.
I've got lots of questions, you know, as always. You know, Subul, you told me a story about how you tried to get some images for your book. Would you mind sharing that as you tried to get different images for your book and what the publisher kept presenting you?
Oh, okay. Well, actually, both my first two books have funny stories about the covers. So my second one, it's called Growing Up Muslim, Understanding the Beliefs and Practices of Islam, and it's for ages 10 and up. So sometimes I think, I tell people, look, if you don't have a lot of time to read and you want answers, just go get the 10 and up book. And so what people may not know is that publishers have the control over the title and the cover. The author doesn't have any control over that. But all my publishers have been very kind about consulting with me. So my second book, which is published by an imprint of Random House, they contacted me and said, okay, here's a cover picture that we have for your book. What do you think? And it was a bunch of kids, but they were all black and brown. So I said, well, you know, actually there are blonde Muslims too and white Muslims in the world. Like the Turks can be blonde. There are American Muslims who are, you know, Caucasian. So can we have a blonde? And also, maybe we could have a girl in a headscarf because I want to be inclusive. Most Muslim girls don't actually wear headscarves, especially not when they're in middle school, but I want to be inclusive. So they said, okay, fine. So they sent another one. They sent another book cover picture, and I said, "Oh, this is great! I see that there's a girl in a headscarf." But I thought we were going to have a blonde, and my publisher said, "Yeah, she's the one in the headscarf."
Oh no!
So it was a twofer.
Yeah, I think that's an important story because it gets at how our belief systems shape the things that we look at or produce, and it really gets at this idea that we really don't understand Islam or Muslims, and we, you know, we have to deal with those things from our own perspectives. So the work you're doing, I think, is exceptionally valuable. That would be an appropriate story for you to share in light of the conversations we were just having. But I just want to say that
my first book has my photograph on it, and I've had several people. Well, people say all kinds of things about my book cover. I didn't realize that once your picture is on the book, you're sort of public property.
But, whoa, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, it feels like it. So, but people have told me, like teachers have told me that their students looked at the book cover and said, that's not a Muslim woman.
Mm-hmm.
And people have said, oh, actually, this is the weirdest thing. I've seen long conversations about how, well, her skin is really darker than in the book cover picture. And so the publisher must have lightened it on purpose to make her more palatable to the public.
Oh, my.
Can you believe it?
No.
And I'm just like, that's what medium brown skin looks like under bright lights. That's just what I look like under bright lights.
But that really is the point, though, right? That is the point. That is the point. You know, we have these paradigms and stereotypes about what other people should look like or be like. And we never really explore enough to get to know them and to see what's, if you will, under the cover, right? And that's part of what I think brings so many problems to light because we're always trying to differentiate people based on our own images of what they should be. You know, whether it's you see a Mexican American and you say, oh, that's a lazy person, or a black person, you have another stereotype, or an Asian person. And it really mm-hmm. gets us into trouble and creates many of the problems that we're talking about, in this conversation and the one, that we had last time. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a question that's kind of been gnawing at me. Last time, I believe you spoke and said that that Muslims and Jews and Christians all have the same God. There's only one God. So my question is, why do we have so many religious conflicts? You know, what's the essence of that? Why did we have crusades? When Bush was going into Iraq, I think it was in Iraq, not Afghanistan, he mentioned crusade and he got chastised for that. So what's the basis for all these problems?
Well, can I just tell you a Star Trek story to
illustrate? Sure. Oh, any? Of course.
Stories are good.
So Captain Kirk was my first crush, and I grew up watching reruns of Star Trek. And there was one episode where he went to a planet where everybody had been killed, and there were only two people left on this whole planet, and they were bent on killing each other, and. Both of them were sort of dressed the same way, and their faces were half black and half white. And
that was one of my favorite episodes.
Mine too. Please continue.
Excuse me. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
So they're bent on killing each other, and Captain Kirk says, "Why do you hate each other so much?" And one of the guys says, "Because of the way he looks." And Captain Kirk says, "What are you talking about? You look exactly the same. Your faces are half black and half white." And the guy says, "No, are you blind? My face is black on the right side, and his face is black on the left side."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So human beings are going to find something to fight about, no matter what there is. It doesn't, even families don't get along. Religion is just another excuse. It's like having your face black on the right side instead of the left. So that's the first point. It's just another reason that allows people to do what they want to do, which is fight each other. Second, there have been far, far, far more wars for territory than there have been wars for religion. There have been far more people killed because of wars for resources and wars over infrastructure and wars over territory than have been killed in wars of religion. So that's the second point. And the third point is that in thinking about these conflicts, people forget how much good is done by religion. So, the Red Cross, for example, started out as a religious entity. All religions, I think, require their adherents to give charity. This is one of the five tenets of Islam, is donation to charity. And maybe I wouldn't remember to give so much if I didn't have a constant religious reminder. Like every Ramadan, I have to give extra charity. So, also, I was just reading that religious groups have been on the forefront of accepting and bringing in refugees and not assimilating them, but helping them adjust to their new surroundings. So that's my answer.
Well, that's a great answer, and we're in for a 2-minute break. If you want to go get a sip of water, Zumbel.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. In addition, if you'd like to be added to our news group, you may text Be Bold America to 22828. Text Be Bold America to 22828. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Ralph Waldo Emerson told of a dinner guest who went on about the virtue of honesty, offering his own life as a model of perfect rectitude. The louder he talked of his honor, said Emerson, the faster we counted our spoons. That's my reaction to the cacophony of phony piety arising from Republican governors and legislators who are trying to enact more than 250 new state laws to stop Black, Latino, Asian American, Indigenous, and other non-Caucasian voters from casting ballots. Yet they proclaim, we're not racist, we're righteous crusaders protecting the sanctity of the vote. Really? So why are they specifically targeting people of color with their repressive voting restrictions? For example, panicky Republican lawmakers in Georgia tried to outlaw any early voting on Sundays. Odd. Why? It's a flagrantly racist attack on the Black church. For years, a joyous civic tradition called Souls to the Polls has played out in Southern Black churches on Sundays prior to Election Day. After the sermon and prayers, congregants, ministers, musicians, and others in the church family travel in a caravan to early voting locations to cast ballots. It turns voting into a civic, spiritual, and fun experience. What kind of shriveled soul tries to kill that? Apparently, the same shameful souls in the Georgia GOP who want to stop local groups from providing water and snacks to citizens forced to wait for hours in line to vote. They're actually trying to make it a crime to give water to thirsty voters. Hey, Republicans, what would Jesus do? This is Jim Hightower saying the goal and duty of every public official ought to be to maximize voter turnout. After all, the more Americans who vote, the stronger our democracy. But there's the ugly political truth. Republican officials no longer support democracy. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Sambo Ali Karamali, and our topic is being Muslim on the other side of the veil. Sambo grew up in Southern California, answering questions about Islam and Muslims, and now she sees scare tactics and deliberate misinformation campaigns by anti-Muslim propagandists who insist wrongly that Sharia is a draconian and oppressive Islamic law. And that's why she wrote Demystifying Sharia, What It Is, How It Works, and Why It's Not Taking Over the Country. And did you get your glass of water, Sambo?
I did. I feel better now. Thank you.
Oh, good for you. You know, I just wanted to mention something that I facilitated a meeting on information literacy in Alexandria, Egypt, many years ago, is before the awakening. And, you know, I was talking to a small group of people, and I mentioned that a man wrote the Quran, and the women in the van with me looked at me aghast, like that was wrong. And they were very biblical people, and I know from their frame of reference, it's putting the word of, you know, the Bible is the word of God. So the Quran, that was written by a man, right?
So this is a bit of a source of confusion to people.
Yes, thank you for help clarify it.
Yeah. So perhaps I can tell you a bit about how the Quran came about, and then you can see what the problem is. You know, the Prophet Muhammad was born in about the year 570 in Mecca, what is now Saudi Arabia. And he was very concerned with social justice. He had been an orphan. He lost his family members early in his life. So he was always concerned about taking care of other people. When he was 40, he was meditating in his retreat, which he made a habit of. And it was dark. It was nighttime. And all of a sudden, he felt something squeeze him. And he heard a voice say, read or recite. It can mean sort of both things. And he said, I don't know how to read, because he is what is described as unlettered. So maybe not entirely illiterate, but unlettered. And again, he was squeezed, and the voice said, read or recite. And again, he said, but I don't know how to read. And a third time he was squeezed. And this time when he said, "I don't know how to read," the voice said, "Read in the name of your Lord who created man from a clot of blood." Now Muslims believe, well, first of all, Muhammad was really scared, because I'd be really scared too if I was sitting in the dark and something squeezed me and said words to me. And he ran down and he told his wife what had happened. And she said, "You know, I have a Christian cousin. Let's go ask him." And the Christian cousin said, "You're a prophet. You're the prophet who's been foretold, and that was the voice of God that spoke to you." So Muslims believe that the words that Muhammad heard while he was meditating were words brought to him by the angel Gabriel. So Muslims believe that these were that God said these words, gave them to the angel Gabriel, who gave them to the prophet Muhammad. Now, throughout the next 23 years of his life until he died, Muhammad would receive these revelations. He would hear these words being said to him, which Muslims believe were the word of God spoken through the angel Gabriel. Muhammad would say them out loud, and then his followers would write them down on whatever papers were at hand, whatever materials were at hand. And within 20 years of Muhammad's death, these papers were all compiled into one book called the Quran. Now, since it was compiled, Muslims have been very careful not to change a word of the Quran, because we believe that it is the words of God, and you can't just go rewriting the words of God. So that doesn't mean, like, just because the words of the Quran have not changed in 1400 years, doesn't mean that our understanding of the Quran cannot change. So the Quran is not static. It applies to all situations, and therefore we can look at it again and reevaluate it for a new situation. In fact, there's something called the reason for revelation. And if the reason for revelation was a historical circumstance, and that historical circumstance is no longer in the world, then perhaps that verse also doesn't apply to the modern situation. So that is, getting back to your question, that is what is makes Muslims sort of cringe when people mm-hmm. say, when people say that a man wrote the Quran. Well, no, we believe it was God who spoke through the angel Gabriel. We don't, I mean, obviously, I don't think that, I understand that not everybody believes that, right? I understand that other people can think that Muhammad wrote the Quran, but that, to Muslims, is a little bit difficult to hear, because we believe that it was God who wrote the Quran. In a way, the Quran is more like Jesus is to Christianity. It's not, the Bible is really not equivalent to the Quran, because they serve different functions and they're different. In a way, the Quran, as kind of a product of God, is more equivalent to Jesus, who is the Son of God in Christianity.
Well, that was very helpful, Sumbul. And I'm sorry to make you cringe.
No. I don't cringe.
You can ask
me anything.
Good. I just being a Caucasian woman, I've heard part of that story, and so that's mm-hmm. why I thought of one. But when you tell the full story, and the background, it is really enlightening. Pettis, you have a question at the tip of your tongue.
I do. Let's continue along this particular line. I was reading in your book in chapter 9, where you talk about the Old Testament and the death penalty for stubborn children. And I'd like to get your take on it, because I was a stubborn child and I would not be here if it was taken as literally as it's presented. But you also talk about the use of homilies and how you interpret religious texts and how that might get distorted based. And I'm thinking in this case of people like that are part of the Taliban, as opposed to other Muslims who have a kinder, gentler view of the Quran.
Mm-hmm. So as with all religions, there are literalists and there are people who don't take every word of their religious text literally, right? In college, I had a friend whose boyfriend, she eventually broke up with her boyfriend because her boyfriend, it got to the point where he would show up every day with a Bible, and what they did depended on what he had read in the Bible that day, because he was turning into a literalist, and she was not, so they broke up. So we all are familiar with this, right? Some people will take things literally. Some people have a more broad understanding of them, and that is true in the case of interpreting our U.S. Constitution. It's true with interpreting religious texts. The Taliban are even outside that. They are not literalists. They are not fundamentalists. They have no understanding of Islam at all. And this is a little bit of a digression, but I think it's important for people to understand the Taliban didn't arise from religion. They didn't arise from religious schooling. They arose from essentially the U.S.'s proxy war in Afghanistan, which we instigated to fight the Soviets. So just very briefly, what happened, as your listeners might know, in 1978, the Afghans instituted a pro-Soviet government. They themselves, in Afghanistan, established a pro-Soviet government. And this really worried the Carter administration. And so the Carter administration contacted Pakistan and said, we'll give you aid if you start aiding the rebels in Afghanistan to overturn this pro-Soviet government. 6 months later, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. And so the U.S. started to funnel more money into the country. And what they did is basically instigate an American jihad. So there hadn't been a jihad, there hadn't been a jihad in Muslim lands anywhere for 100 years. But the CIA started one because they wanted to fight the Soviets, and so they started recruiting Muslims and saying, it is your holy duty to go and fight these Soviets. And they partnered with Pakistan's ISI, which is their intelligence agency, and they turned a lot of the madrasas, which are religious schools, especially along the Pakistan-Afghan border, they turned them into military training schools. And so they took these young men and boys and put them in these military training schools and trained them to go and fight Soviets. There weren't any girls there. They were told that it was their religious duty. They even provided them with textbooks. So there was an education center in Afghanistan which used textbooks that were designed at the University of Nebraska. And it is shocking. These textbooks were for third, fourth graders. They were for kids learning to read. And the examples would be things like K is for Kalashnikov, B is for blood. There's a third grade textbook that actually the word problems, I can actually read you probably the literal word problem in this third grade textbook. It said, and this is for 8-year-olds, remember, it said one group of Mujahideen, which is the Muslim fighters, one group of Mujahideen attacked 50 Russian soldiers. In that attack, 20 Russians are killed. How many Russians fled?
Wow.
Is that amazing? This is third graders. And so you have these elementary school textbooks designed at the University of Nebraska teaching kids to, like, pluck out the eyes of Russians. And that,
oh, my.
So that is how the Mujahideen, who are the fighters against the Soviets, arose. The U.S. not only gave them arms and money, but also taught them how to be private terrorist militias. So one of these groups eventually was called Al-Qaeda. Now, when the Soviet Union withdrew, when the U.S. left, there were all these Mujahideen groups, and they began to fight each other because they were all very disparate, and that ended up in the civil war in Afghanistan. The Taliban, who had also studied at these same schools, arose after the Mujahideen because both the U.S. and Pakistan were afraid of nationalist movements. At that time, you remember, the Soviet Union was considered godless, and so By contrast, the U.S. took religious groups in order to fight them. And so they started, Pakistan started supporting the Taliban. And the U.S. was okay with that, too. And initially, the Taliban did get support because they said they were going to unarm Afghanistan and they were going to bring peace, which, of course, they didn't do. I mean, they brought law and order, but it was so brutal and so awful, especially to women, that it wasn't really peace. But that is how they came to power. So, you know, I've read a lot in the media lately about how, oh, the Afghans just don't have our values, and they just don't understand democracy, and they're too tribal to be governed. And there's almost no acknowledgement that we're the ones who started 50 years of warfare in Afghanistan.
I'm so glad you're covering that part of our history.
I am too. And
very brief.
Your list.
Very brief. And I
need to take a break. Assemble.
Yes,
hold on. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Want a friend to hear this program? Listen on the Be Bold America webpage at ksqd.org, or they may subscribe to the show for free at their favorite podcast platform. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Tune in to KSQD Sunday at 6 p.m. for State of Mind, produced by local therapist Deborah Sloss. Gender-based violence affects 1 in 3 girls. Teens and college students are particularly vulnerable to domestic abuse, sexual violence, and dating violence. The coronavirus pandemic has led to a significant increase in calls to crisis lines and requests for support services. Last year, 4 women were killed in domestic violence homicides in Santa Cruz County. For survivors, the mental health impacts are substantial, including such symptoms as PTSD, depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicidal behavior. Listen to this show with a teen or young adult and help them be more aware and prepared to prevent such violence. Join us for new understandings and seeds of possibility on State of Mind, Sunday evening at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org.
Today, our topic is being Muslim on the other side of the veil, and we're speaking with Sambal Ali Karamali. Sambal grew up in Southern California answering questions about Islam and Muslims, and with her degree in English from Stanford University, her law degree from the University of California at Davis, and her additional law degree in Islamic law from the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies, she left the world of corporate law to start writing books to answer those very questions. Now, checking in with you, Sambal, because we're in our last few minutes, and I want to make sure you finished your thought. I have 3 questions that I just want to get quick answers to as well. So finish your thought there before the break.
So my point was that there are literalists and there are people who interpret texts more broadly, but the Taliban are really neither of those. They really don't have any understanding whatsoever of Sharia. So that was my point.
It was really very helpful, and I think our media needs to take a lesson from you. So here's one of my quick questions. What mm-hmm. is the Islamophobia industry? Was the textbook for 8-year-olds a result of that, or what is it?
No. So the textbook, that was a long time ago. That was in the 80s. So that was something that was designed because of the Cold War because of the proxy war between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The Islamophobia Network really started after 9/11. And this is a loose network of organizations and individuals who make a lot of money spreading misinformation about Muslims, spreading fear and misinformation. If your readers would like to see who the players are, there's a website, islamophobianetwork.com. I think that's what it is.
Islamophobianetwork.com.
Yeah, let me just make sure. It's islamophobianetwork.com, and it's the report by the Center for American Progress called Fear, Inc. And it's several years old now. There are hundreds of millions of dollars being funneled into this network to spread misinformation about Muslims, but that will at least give you an idea of what we're talking about.
Thank you. And then another quick one. When I was reading your book, I read that there's a relationship between Islam and the English common law. What is a connection? Do you remember that one?
Okay. Yes, of course I do.
Oh, good.
It's a bit... Okay, then I'll try to say it in a nutshell. So English common law developed in the 12th century when the English king at the time wanted to overhaul it. At that time, the Sharia-based legal system was already 500 years old. It was mature. A lot of the concepts that we think of as American or English actually were in Islamic law for 500 years before the English came up with them. So, like... You don't, there's no duty to incriminate yourself. Everybody needs a fair trial. You're innocent until proven guilty. Those actually were in Islamic law for hundreds of years before English common law was developed. And it is very likely that our English common law was influenced by Islamic law. At the time that Islamic law was 500 years old, in England, they were still doing trials by fire and trials by water. So, when they wanted to overhaul the system, it just makes sense, right, that you would look at other systems that are older and get influence from them. They're both case law systems, and they're very similar in structure, unlike the French civil law system. So most of Europe is on the French civil law system, except for England, and it's always been a puzzle. Well, why is England different? Well, probably because the English had a connection with Sicily where there had been Islamic law.
See, I just thought that connection to today and our Western civilization, it sort of bridges the two, the something that seems foreign, which is Islam, that's connecting mm-hmm. right to our everyday lives. And then again, mm-hmm. quickly, how did the Hadith, how did the linguistic analysis of Hadith lead to science of code breaking? Pop quiz.
Hadith.
Hadith, thank you.
Yeah, hadith. And what that is the written record of the prophet's words and deeds. So Muslims consider the prophet's words and deeds to be divinely guided, but the record of his words and deeds is man-made, right? People tried to write down what the prophet said. They might have gotten it wrong. When the early Islamic scholars were trying to figure out which of these reports on what the prophet said, which of them are accurate and which are not, they actually developed linguistics and statistics and eventually developed the science of code breaking, cryptanalysis, which came out of this these areas. And before the Arabs developed cryptanalysis, very simple codes went unbroken because people didn't know how to do it. But it sort of came out of their linguistic analysis of the prophet's words.
I think that's just absolutely fascinating. Now, Pettis, yeah. Before we get to our keep, stop, start, we have a couple minutes for a question.
Thank you, Jill. Today is a fascinating discussion, and I think we've covered a lot of ground as you've talked about how the nature of warfare being really economic at its root, but the use of the church or politics to generate it is, I think, a very important thing to underscore. But can you say a little bit about your walking from L.A. to New Orleans on a daily basis?
Yes, every day one summer I walked from Los Angeles to New Orleans. New Orleans Square, to be more specific, at Disneyland. because, yes, I worked at Disneyland. Gave me appreciation for Disneyland. But, of course, as I got a bit older, I was very conflicted because, on the one hand, you have to admire Disney. On the other hand, they've done a lot of really kind of prejudicial, xenophobic, bordering on racist things. So... Aladdin, in particular, was an appalling movie.
Also, if you could tell us in
one minute,
very quickly.
Mm-hmm. If I could tell you what Pet is, I'm sorry.
A little bit more about Aladdin, what you were saying about it.
Okay. Briefly, it just had all sorts of lyrics that were horrible. Like in Arabia, it's barbaric, but it's home. They cut off your ear if they don't like your face. All these kinds of things. They have, Princess Jasmine's hand being almost cut off and sort of saying that was basically Islamic law. I mean, that's why people think of Islamic law the way they do. So various groups told them to take these things out when the movie first came out, but they didn't do it.
Yeah. So it's reinforcing the stereotypes.
Yes, for young children, too. And just for a minute, again, we have another minute to talk about Keep, Stop, Start. So one thing would be stop watching the movie Aladdin. But what other things might you suggest listeners keep doing, stop doing, and start doing?
Well, keep supporting stations like this one with your listening and with your funding. Muslims are talked about all the time, but often not talked to. So I so appreciate your talking to me.
Oh, it's been an honor for us.
Yes.
And please, you know, so please keep listening to our voices and buying our books to read or donate, because that's what keeps us in print and allows us to keep our voices out there. Stop doing, as a country, I think we need to stop supporting the Islamophobes. And you know, our government keeps hiring them to teach and speak about Islam. And again, you can look at the IslamophobiaNetwork.com to see who they are. Sometimes they're best-selling authors, so we can stop buying their books.
Mm.
And finally, what should we start doing? Let's start challenging implicit bias more, and outright bias, actually, in our media. Even people you wouldn't think. Joy Reid on MSNBC and Don Lemon on CNN, they both made casually Islamophobic comments that they never apologized for. So, you know, write letters, tweets, do whatever, leave comments, and speak up when you encounter anti-Muslim prejudice.
Thank you so much, Sumbul. Thank you. And I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, and our program director, Howard Feldstein. And once again, give a huge thank you to our bold and impressive guest, Sumbul Ali Karamali. We're so glad you had some time for us tonight, Sumbul.
Well, I was honored too. Thank you to you both.
Thank you. We were honored as well. And again, live long and prosper.
To both of you.
Thank you. On Sunday, September 12th, on Be Bold America, Pettis and I will be speaking with Richard Leader, who is the co-author of Who Do You Want to Be When You Grow Old? The Path of Purposeful Aging. For many years, both Pettis and I have been highly interested in how we all can live a more meaningful life. For me, it is raising awareness of our faltering democracy. And for Pettis, it's teaching and valuing and celebrating diversity in our country. And our next guest, Richard Leader, is focused on helping those of us getting older to lead a more purposeful and meaningful life. As he says, everyone is getting older, but not everyone is growing older. So join us on Sunday, September 12th at 5 p.m. to hear Who Do You Want to Be When You Grow Old? You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, Many Voices, One Station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for State of Mind with Deborah Schloss. My name is Jill Cody.
And I'm Pettis Perry.
And thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.